I think I was quite an annoying child. I always wanted to rebel against things. I got into trouble a lot and I always talked back at people. So I think this was destined to be my career.
Hello and welcome to the Waterstones podcast. I'm Will Rycroft and in this episode, we're going to challenge what life or other people expect from us. It isn't just 2020 that has altered some of the most basic assumptions about how life works. The millennial generation have grown up in a world already radically different from that of their parents. Emma Gannon has been one of that generation to articulate how working life has changed, and in her debut novel, Olive, she follows a protagonist who dares to say out loud what many still consider to be taboo. She's a woman who doesn't want to have children. I spoke to Emma about why we struggle so much with this idea, what words like maternal and family really mean, and why fiction was the best place for her to talk about the decision to live a child-free life. Emma, thank you for joining us so much on the Waterstones podcast from home.
Thank you so much. This is very exciting. The iconic Waterstones podcast.
Well, I feel like I'm speaking to podcast royalty and speaking to you. I mean, this is an absolute pleasure for me. We're here to talk about your debut novel, Olive. Many people will know you from your podcasting or indeed from the non-fiction books you've written. But here we have a novel. Before we get into the book itself and sort of where it came from, I've called this episode Expectations because there's this idea of the kind of the expectations that society or family might place on us or what we're expected to do with our lives and what happens when we sort of go against that. And I wondered if I could ask, first of all, whether growing up you sort of were aware of any expectations.
Yeah, I think I have always been aware of expectations. I think everyone is, you know, from a young age, you realise what your parents' definition of success is. You realise what your friends' parents want for their children. And I think I could just objectively look at it all, take it in. But I think I was always sort of looking at it from outside, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I was aware of it, but I'm quite an annoying person. I think I was quite an annoying child. I always wanted to rebel against things. I got into trouble a lot and I always talked back at people. So I think this was destined to be my career.
I can almost see your school reports now.
Oh, yes. You'd have a field day, seriously.
I mean, because I think everybody does grow up and there are certain expectations that might come from their family in terms of like what you might do for a job or the sort of the kind of family that you might have, because it's sort of, I guess, shaped by how your family works. And that could be, I suppose, a positive or a negative thing. And then there are the more social or cultural expectations that surround us. I guess the most obvious things are that most people will have an idea that, you know, you grow up, you get married, you have kids, you get a job, you buy a house. Those are pretty basic things. But it seems that almost all of those are being challenged in various ways, either by people choosing to do things differently or by the way that actually society has changed and those things aren't quite so important. You sort of put a shout out on Twitter some time ago where you wanted to hear from people who had decided not to have children in their lives. You wanted to hear their stories. As you said, it was for a thing, and that thing has become Olive the novel. But I just wondered where that instinct to ask that question first came from. Was it because you knew you wanted to write a novel with a character who was sort of making that choice? Or was it just out of interest? Or, you know, what was the spark for that question being asked, first of all?
Yeah, it was definitely a mixture of all of that. I mean, that's sort of why I love Twitter. And I know it's, you know, hell in many ways, that place, because it's just so polarizing and awful. But I also do love it as a writer still, as a tool to just put a little idea out there and test the water. And I put that tweet out, and yeah, it was for a thing, which was going to be an article. I just thought, I really want to hear from some child-free women who have decided that by choice, because I've got to be honest, I kind of was feeling that way myself. And I'm sure it's no surprise that bits of myself are in Olive, but I just turned 30 and I always knew in my 20s I wasn't ready for children. And I thought it was just, oh, I'm not ready. And then I hit 30 and I was like, no, I really don't think I ever want them. And I think I just wanted to reach out, talk to people. But also I didn't have to say anything about myself in that moment. I could just use it under the guise of being a journalist, which is so much fun when you can do that hashtag journo request, when really you're just being incredibly nosy and wanting other people's stories. So I felt really seen and happy and heard and comforted and connected when I got all those replies. And yeah, it turned into something much bigger.
I suppose when you got those replies, as you say, it was validating in a way for you, you know, to sort of see that you weren't alone in your thoughts. But did you find that people's reasons for wanting to be child-free were very varied, or was there something that sort of bound them all together?
Yeah, very different reasoning, but really that similarity of knowing from quite a young age. And I think we know quite a lot about ourselves from childhood. I write quite a lot about rediscovering your childhood self in terms of careers. You know, I think people get to that quarter life crisis moment and think, oh, what is my job and what am I doing? And I feel so, so lost. And I think that is a bit of career advice that people give out is, well, what did you like as a child and what made you happy? And did you write stories or did you do a lot of things with your hands or were you very active? And I think in that moment, I realized, oh my God, I was that kid as well, but I didn't really have the dolls. I didn't really pretend to look after my toys in that way. Like maybe I'm maternal in different ways, but I definitely think there were clues. And that came across in the women's stories. They were like, I've always known, but I've always kept it a secret because I felt embarrassed when all my friends were getting really excited about the idea of babies and I didn't. And so I think there is this element of shame a little bit still there, which I wanted to explore. But on the whole, all these women I interviewed were unapologetic. They were fulfilled. They were happy. They didn't really have any regrets. And I also wanted to tap into the millennial, you know, cohort during writing Olive, because I think there's maybe new reasons, perhaps, that financially we're not as secure than maybe generations above, or we're maybe a bit more conscious about the environment, or our careers are just going incredibly well. And we're not sure if we want to change that. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
That is really interesting. As you say, that there is something very different about this generation, or rather the world that they live in. Things have changed. Like, if you want to buy a house, something that would seem pretty basic to a lot of people growing up 50 years ago, it's incredibly difficult to buy a house. You have to save so much money now. You have to have a massive deposit. Being a first-time buyer is really tricky. And so there is a whole generation who have kind of resigned themselves to maybe never owning property. And that's just one aspect of the things that we're talking about, of expectations. But as you say, that thing of, if careers are different now, if your working life is different now, and if the financial burden of having a child is different now, there is thought that has to go into it before you commit to it. And in a way, that strikes me as a good thing, because I think there are a lot of people who might automatically become parents without any thought, and they're terrible at it because they find that actually it's incredibly difficult and they're not well suited to it at all, and maybe a bit of forethought might have been a better idea.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, it's funny with, you know, wanting to impress our parents. I interviewed an author recently who was like, I'm still trying to impress my dad and he's in his 70s or 80s even. And I just thought it was really funny that we do try and follow a path sometimes so that it looks really shiny on the outside to other people. And I think that's what millennials have struggled with, is our parents don't know what we do half the time. Our job titles are slightly different now, perhaps, in the internet era. And maybe it's the same for the paths that we choose in our lives. Maybe we don't want to settle down. Maybe we want to travel the world. Maybe we don't want to have children. So, yeah, it's definitely changing. And for me, I just really wanted to kind of dig into this idea that there is a generational divide, which means that the role models are not quite there yet in terms of seeing someone kind of do it all. I remember watching my Gen X boss at my old job just be completely frazzled, if I'm being honest. She had two children, an amazing job. She was an incredible woman and very successful, but she was really struggling. And she was constantly on the phone to her babysitter or her nanny, and she was constantly late for meetings. And I was like, oh my God, you know, this having it all thing is a bit of a myth. And maybe we need to be a bit more honest about that.
A bit of honesty is definitely a good thing. I mean, you mentioned there about sort of Generation X, and we talk about millennials, a slight difference there. But one thing where I am completely out of my depth, of course, is talking about female friendship. Actually, I say completely out of my depth. It's not quite true. My schooling, I was in a school which was basically all girls, apart from a few boys. So I've spent my life surrounded by female friendship, but there is something very particular about it. And obviously Olive and her group of friends in the novel are a great example of what is different about female friendship as opposed to male friendship. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because there is something uniquely close about female friendship, but of course that closeness can lead to conflict and problems, as Olive discovers, when people start to have different desires and different sort of things driving them. When did you sort of maybe become aware of that little conflict that can arrive when timing means that some friends start talking about babies and wanting them and families and settling down, whilst others are thinking, that is not what's driving me at all?
Yeah, well, I obviously only know about female friendship from my own point of view, but from my experience, it's very intense. Female friendship is very intimate and very kind of touchy-feely, and you're in each other's lives, you're in each other's bedrooms, you know everything about each other, and there's no closeness like it, I think, when you're in your teens or 20s with your female friends. And it really is so special. And I think you grow up together really in tandem. You have all these milestones that are the same, you know, from bodily functions to boyfriends and, you know, going to university, going to London, maybe for your first job, you know, whatever it is, you seem to follow a path together up until a certain point when you all start to change a bit more, I think. And for someone that knows so much about someone inside and out, I think sometimes it can be quite shocking or surprising when your friend turns around and goes, guess what, I'm pregnant, or, you know, we're trying for a baby. It's almost like that feeling of, oh, wait a minute, why wasn't I consulted? or at least you can feel slightly torn in terms of jealousy or fear that maybe they're going to go on and have a different life that doesn't include you. And I really wanted to include that honesty because it's quite a sticky subject, and it's not a great character trait that Olive has, where she's you know, she's very nosy, and also she's really scared that her friends are going to leave her behind. So I really wanted to kind of touch on that.
I think it happens. I remember that sort of stage in life where my generation was starting to get married, to have families. And of course, what it means is that these very tight friendship groups that you have start to break apart. And of course, people dedicate time to their spouses and their kids and all the rest of it. So there's this huge fracturing. And so we're not often honest about the fact that actually we can be quite resentful when people go off and dare to have a life of their own with somebody else. And it's quite hard to maintain those friendships. But I think that, as you say, the intensity of female friendship means that the amount that you share growing up together means that it makes that split all the more difficult, and therefore all the more perfect for writing fiction about, because of course it provides lots of potential for drama and conflict and the rest of it. I mean, does it also mean that when you come back together and that there is that honesty, of that emotional honesty that women are much better at than men, that there is something to be learned when women share the different experiences that they've been through?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really wanted to make that point in the book, that this is not a mums versus non-mums battle, you know, and I think that's the stereotype. I think the stereotype is you won't be invited to anything if you don't have children, and your friends will go and meet their new best friends at their NCT classes and leave you behind. And I suppose I wanted to put all these insecurities in a book, but, you know, no spoilers, obviously. But, you know, this is a story of beautiful friendships at the end of the day that stand the test of time. And I really wanted to show that. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, being a woman is enough. It's not that you have to be a mother to be a woman. You know, I wanted to show that we have so much more in common than we don't, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I think there are these things out there. So this idea about what makes a mother, or the idea of what does maternal actually mean? It's considered to be a sort of completely natural instinct that all women have, that they completely understand how to look after a baby, and that they have this special bond that fathers don't have and things like that. And that's not a myth, but it's far more complex than that. And in fact, as somebody who feels that they don't want to have children, I'm sure you have ideas about how you are comfortable being maternal, perhaps with the children of relatives or friends, that you can still have that bond with children, but not necessarily want to have them yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And I think some people do sort of assume that you might hate children, which is obviously not the case. And when I interviewed these amazing women for the book, a lot of them were children's teachers and pediatricians and children's authors. You know, these were women that really, really liked children. And I think that's important to say. And also my friends, you know, they know my stance on all of this. They've read Olive. They get it. And what's really nice about fiction is, yes, of course, it's all made up, but at the heart of it, I feel like someone's kind of reading me and understanding me. And I think they all read it and got it, which was really nice. But they're still, they very much see me as a maternal and nourishing element of their lives. You know, I still very much want to hold their babies and I very much want to be there playing with them and being, it's almost like a new role, which I think is really important, you know, being the auntie, being the children's mother's friend, you know, being this person in their life that maybe does have a bit more time on the surface to give back in other ways. And so yeah, I don't think anyone thinks I'm cold and uncaring for not wanting them, but I do think that's still a stereotype that's floating around, so it's good to talk about it.
Yeah, because of coming from an arts background, I'm very aware of the fact that a lot of artists have remained childless because they have absolutely poured that instinct to create something that will live on after them into their art rather than into having a family. And that's almost, again, a bit of a cliche in itself. But I just sort of wonder, obviously, you have already a huge body of work behind you with your nonfiction writing, your podcasting, and now with a novel. And I wondered whether your own creativity is something where you channel some of that energy right now, and in fact, possibly, you know, forever, that you feel that's how you're leaving a legacy, if you like, rather than through having children.
I mean, it's a lovely feeling to know that I'm never going to be bored, which is really nice, because I know that whatever happens, I'm going to have something that I love doing. But also, I do find it really cringy when people talk about their books as like giving birth or having a baby. I'm like, it's not though, is it? You know, yes, okay, a book has taken me 2 years and I've been talking about it for ages and I'm ready for it to come out. There is a similarity in like brewing something for a long time and then releasing it into the world and feeling like you've created. I get the parallel there. But I think that, weirdly, I've seen many examples of the other way around, that if you want to be creative, the best thing to do is to have children, because you have to kind of get more done in a smaller space of time. Mm-hmm. And we all know that having a deadline is actually great for getting some work done. But I've read a lot that Zadie Smith has said about this. She says that the best thing ever for her was having small children and being able to write her books in a better way. And I really like that, because I don't think this is like a one way is better than the other thing. So, you know, each to their own, I suppose. But I do like the idea of having lots of time ahead of me that I get to sort of fill myself.
Mm. We've sort of spoken a bit about some of your nonfiction and the podcasting, where you've looked at modern life and this idea that whereas people used to get a job, it would be their career, they do it for their whole life, and you would do that in order to sort of do the things that you like doing. Life is so different now. I'm already on my second career. Other people will do sort of maybe three or four main jobs in their life, which is a very, very different way of living. And it sort of ties into this idea as well for Olive, this idea of wanting to have those opportunities to switch and change, which you cannot do so easily, I suppose, if you have the ties of family or children to look after. Do you feel, I suppose, as a millennial who has written so much about this, that this is an exciting time, albeit uncertain, but that it allows people to really fulfill their potential, whereas actually the more standard way of living, this idea of having very basic expectations on life, would force people into roles where they wouldn't actually be happy for their whole life?
Yeah, I mean, it's two very different things, and I think they get conflated sometimes. I know that when I released The Multi-Hyphen Method, which was a book really for people who would go into Waterstones and look for a book like that, you know, it was for someone that was probably a smaller percentage of the UK who were like, oh, actually, I quite fancy doing three different jobs. So it was sort of more of a choice and more of a lifestyle book. But what's interesting is it did bring up all this conversation about the precarious nature of work and also the fact that some people are pushed into having multiple jobs, and that's kind of different, because that's not an entrepreneurial choice of running a few different income streams. That's, oh God, I've got to make ends meet and this is horrible. And so I think I'm really proud that that book brought up lots of conversations that were also very uncomfortable. I thought, you know, it's good to talk about it. But for me, I mean, it's quite interesting. I do thrive having multiple things going on. You know, I've got my podcast, I've got my nonfiction, my novels. I'm starting all sorts of different like side hustles still. My brain thrives off that. And there are a lot of people who find that they do their best work when they have multiple things going on. But the truth is as well that I really wanted the full-time job. I got a job at Condé Nast when I was 25, 26. And I wanted to be there forever. I was so happy that I got that email address and I was in the building and I like had the employee badge. Like I was ready to sign up for a lifelong job there. And the truth is that that's not the case. You know, even if you want that, you're not going to have a job for life. You know, my grandparents had that and they literally worked in the same place for like 60 years and they had almost like that family feel of like being employed where their employer would cover their bills and their house and, you know, they would like house people if they struggled. And that's amazing. But that's not the world we live in now. Far from it. So, yeah, it's a bit of both. And I think it's a very personal decision, kind of what works for us.
I mean, I suppose one thing that this year has taught us is that you have to be able to adapt. And I'm sure for so many people, this year has completely pulled the rug from underneath them in terms of any stability they might have had may have been changed. As somebody who is obviously a multi-hyphen worker and a freelancer, how have you found this year? Have you felt that you were sort of prepared for it in a way, or has it changed the way that you work or the kind of things that you do? What's 2020 been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought at first that I would be perfectly set up for this because I work from home anyway. Everything I do is pretty much online. Everything I do is kind of a digital business. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very, very lucky. I feel very set up for this just by chance, really. But what I've realized is actually I don't work from home the whole time. I still thrive from being flexible and being able to work from cafes or, you know, co-working spaces or in the offices of friends of mine. So I've really missed that. I've really missed going out and about and seeing people in person. So I'm sure I've struggled alongside many others to adapt to this. I don't think anyone really wants to work from home every single day. I love the choice. I love the fact that I can if I want to, but that's very different from you must work from home every single day. So yeah, it's been really hard. And I really hope that we get some sense of normality back soon, just because human beings are meant to touch each other and talk to each other and see each other's faces. And, you know, that's all part of it, I think.
Well, I suppose, I mean, actually thinking about the things that Olive goes through in the book, there are moments where that female friendship is broken. There are moments where friends aren't talking to each other. And you can see the impact that it has on each of them and the relief that comes when you're able to connect again. And I'm sure there's a little bit of that for everybody at the moment where, yes, you can maintain family and friendships and all the rest of it during lockdown. But actually, there is no substitute for being able to actually, as you say, be in front of somebody to touch them, to sort of have that contact, because it is innately human, isn't it, to have that?
Yeah. I mean, the only positive is that at least we're all in the same boat. And so there's no FOMO going on. It's not, oh, I haven't been invited to that party. It's like, we all know we're sat at home alone. So I think everyone's feeling that. So that makes it slightly easier to manage, maybe. But yeah, you're so right. There's no substitute for an in real life conversation. And I think we're seeing that more and more on Twitter or on social media. You know, people are treating people like they're just a static profile picture with no feelings. Mm. Whereas we would never say half the things we say on the internet to someone's face, I don't think. And so I am worried about that if we become more increasingly digital, we're losing that empathy so much more.
Absolutely. I mean, my sort of fear extends a little bit beyond that even, which is that the way that people interact on Twitter is starting to leak into real life, so that we see these videos now all the time of people having these awful confrontations in the street because somebody's not wearing a mask and they want them to be wearing a mask. And the way that people are sort of yelling at each other face to face now, I think comes from how they're used to engaging with their sort of antagonists on social media. And that worries me, because you think if you're able to sort of yell into somebody's face or spit at them or whatever, you know, this mad behavior going on around coronavirus, I hope that people can learn to sort of be a bit more human once again, once we get used to sort of in real life interactions. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah, you know, I know it's terrifying. And the thing for me is I see it as being really ironic that if you're yelling at someone because you feel like you're right, but you're doing it with so much hatred, how are you better than the person who's in quotes wrong? You know, it's very strange. And I think we need to start talking more openly. And also that's why novels, I think, are amazing, because there is no, you know, finger pointy thing going on at the author. You know, I've said things in Olive that maybe I wouldn't say in real life. And I think that's important. I think, of course, don't be offensive. Don't hurt people's feelings. And there are certain things that absolutely are wrong. And there's no amount of justification. But when I just want to put a little idea out there, I'd rather put it in a novel than put it on Twitter, because there is more empathy if someone's reading a character story rather than just a few characters.
I mean, let's talk a little bit actually about writing a novel. It must be very different to the process of sitting down to write an article or indeed to write a non-fiction book. How did you find that? Did it take a bit of time to adjust to this new way of writing? Did you find it harder? Did you find it easier? How was the process of writing fiction?
Definitely harder. I think with my non-fiction, I'd been writing first person pieces and kind of articles and journalism for, you know, 8 years or so by then. So I felt like it was natural to me. But yeah, fiction was a whole different beast, and you really have to, you're very humbled by it, and there is no creative kind of ego saving you. Like, you're just on the floor starting again, telling, you know, being told that it's wrong or rubbish by the people who love you, and just doing draft after draft after draft, and yeah, just really learning from scratch. And you know, it is hard, because if you change one thing, you're changing the whole novel. And I can only describe it as, like, when I would go into the Word document, I would literally roll up my sleeves, like I was going in to work. Like, it was quite physical in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And I really, really enjoyed it. But I actually read somewhere while I was writing it that Richard Osman, who I'm not comparing myself to, don't worry, he has written an incredible novel. He wrote his novel in secret, I think, for a year and didn't tell anyone, and then sold it. And that's kind of similar to what I did. I just didn't want the pressure, and I didn't want someone at a party going, "How's your novel going?" Because then, for me, that really puts me off, and I feel just like I'm not getting anywhere. Whereas I wrote it in secret, and only my agent knew. And it just felt like my little thing that was mine, and I felt like I was growing closer to this character of Olive all by myself, and that was actually a really enjoyable process.
Because of writing it in secret and then sort of releasing it into the world, does that mean that there is an element of trepidation where you kind of go, right, now I find out what everyone's going to think?
Oh my God, it's terrifying. I think every single author will say the worst feeling in the world is when your book is on submission. And of course, you get the rejections first, because it's a quicker response. You know, if someone doesn't want it, they'll tell you. But then it's the no news is good news, I think, is the line. Because you can wait for a long time before you hear back. And, oh, it's a horrible feeling. You know, you feel so exposed, like all your skin is off. You just feel like everyone's looking inside your diary or inside your drawers. Like, it's just horrible. But it all worked out in the end.
You're talking to an ex-actor, so I know that feeling very, very well. In fact, technically, I'm still waiting to hear back from Rada, who I auditioned for many, many years ago. They never actually got back to me, so I might have a place.
That's so funny. You know, I received a rejection email from a book that was already out. And I just, it made me laugh, but it also made me feel really sad for a book that I'd already done.
That's already, yeah. I mean, at least that's the right time to get that rejection, when you kind of go, well, that's fine. It's already a thing. But yeah, how bizarre. Writing a first novel, I wanted to ask whether there were sort of any books that you had read, novels that you had found sort of either inspiring in creating your own, or that sort of helped you feel confident enough to write fiction.
Well, I love reading novels of authors who have also written nonfiction, just because I guess it just makes me feel like, oh, that's possible. So I really enjoyed Elizabeth Gilbert's City of Girls. And I really loved how, for someone that writes so much about her life, she really goes into completely different worlds in her novels. I really enjoyed recently Harriet Walker's book, The New Girl. Mm-hmm. It was a really sticky book about female competition. And it made me kind of think more about how female friendship can kind of go quite dark sometimes, and how we can turn on each other. So that was quite inspiring. But I really enjoy books that are kind of not very self-conscious and just go there. And I suppose a book maybe that's quite similar in tone would be Dawn O'Porter's book. I think it's called So Lucky. Mm-hmm. And I really like that, because she really just tells the story and the truth about women. You know, she doesn't try and make it look really glamorous and cool. Some of it is just a bit raw and scary and cringy. So, Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't read a ton of fiction, which I think people might find surprising. I read so much nonfiction, but I think that's why I like reading it, is I can get ideas for novels that I'm going to write myself. But yeah, I need to get lost in a good novel again soon.
We certainly have time on our hands, don't we? So it's a good time to read. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning that when you heard back from people on Twitter, their stories that you felt sort of seen. And I think that lots of those people will read Olive and then have that same feeling again. They will feel seen and validated, not just those women who have elected to be child-free like Olive, but also her friendship group, you know, who are all going through their own trials and tribulations. And as you say, that sort of honesty about what women go through in their lives will be there for lots of readers. So thank you for Olive, Emma, and thank you for your time today to talk about it. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, and for asking such great questions. Thank you.
Huge thanks to you all for listening. Some nice book recommendations for you there at the end. In our next episode, we're going to go back to childhood ourselves as we speak to the winners from this year's Waterstones Children's Book Prize. We'll see you then.